back with episode 833 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host. And we have...
Oh, geez, the podcast. Yeah, hi, John. This is Gary from Jacksonville. It's been a little while, so I'll get back into the swing of things.
That's right, as usual, as just when we get done announcing what our plans are for when we're going to record, things take a little bit of a turn. So last week it didn't work out because I had a major allergy attack and I was not able to actually record. But here we are back with the beginning of November coming upon us. It is the Halloween season. That's always fun. Any plans for Halloween, Gary?
We will not, given my children's age, we will not be going door to door ourselves anymore. But now we set up chairs and tables outside the house and give out candy to hopefully creative young children. So that we throw a little fire pit out. It's fun. So it's my kids nice. Are old. Yeah, my kids are old enough to go on their own. So they do. Excellent. Yours are getting on in age too. So I imagine much of the same thing.
Well, they still like to go out and...
Well, who doesn't like free candy, John?
Right. Actually, there's like a group that goes out, and then everyone goes back to one of the houses, and it's kind of like a little mini party, pizza party and so forth, as the case may be. And so it's kind of a hybrid of what you were talking about, where...
Oh.
They get very tired very quickly of running around and just say, hey, you know, we'll order the goodies that come to us.
Oh, fair enough. Yeah, now we still have a lot of younger children in our immediate neighborhood, so we still get a lot of people go around.
Yes, so I hope that everybody is having a good time this Halloween season. Definitely hope that there is still some costuming going on. Come on, guys. I mean, so many of us are nerds and cosplayers, right? So... I know that this is always one of my favorite times of year because usually my convention season is pretty much wrapping up, so I try to use whatever the most what's the word that I should use, the most appropriate or
convenient,
or convenient cosplay as the Halloween costume.
I know. I was like, oh Jesus, should I get dressed in costume? What will I ever wear?
Let me guess, something Star Trek related. I'm just guessing.
All those jumpsuits are easy, John. I admit it. And they just started selling those the new Discovery. Costumes from the Anovos company at $450 some odd.
So yeah, if you order now, you might get them by the time that Discovery is in its sixth season.
Dare to dream, John. Actually, no, it only took them 2.5 years from my last one, so I'll be optimistic. But yeah, nice work, and I never have a complaint with the quality. But yeah, I agree, their timing for distribution is often lacking. So maybe they'll work on that and improve it because they do make good products. So I can only hope. And it's nice to actually see the as they started selling them, and you get the various interactions on social media that there are a lot of people very excited about Discovery. We've been critical about it in some ways and fashions, but at the same time, a lot of people really are enjoying the show tremendously for what it is, and more power to them. More good science fiction is always better in my book. So
That's true. I am still waiting, sadly, my Star Trek Beyond survival jacket, but we'll let that be. Maybe the next movie will come out by the time I get it. But anyhow, it's interesting, as you say. What I see a lot of is complaints about the all-access service and the fact that it doesn't work the way it's supposed to. And yet even some of the people that say, wow, this really doesn't feel like Star Trek, really, this is really not, completely goes against everything that Star Trek stands for, and yet they're commenting on every episode. So it feels like the fans are right back in the swing of things.
Well, fair enough. I mean, and I'm sort of in that bucket too. It seems to be lacking something for me, if nothing else, possibly the morality message that pervades most Star Trek episodes just doesn't seem to be here to a large extent. So that's that's one of the flavors that I'd say I'm missing without going, specific into an episode where the Orville actually is doing that.
Yes. So we'll go get that up more, I'm sure, as the
no,
the
I know, but so on. It's interesting, but like I said, I'm glad that the genre is being actively pursued. So I guess, in one way or the other, I'm meaning science fiction, not just Star Trek in particular. So,
Okay. So that being the case, man, what have you been up to the last couple of weeks?
Oh, geez, John, I've been reading Star Trek.
Oh, really? Same here.
Yeah, actually, you were the one that mentioned the book because I hadn't been following close enough to realize it was out. And I just finished, actually, quite early this morning, reading the latest book, Star Trek Discovery, Desperate Hours. And, well, I still have to sort of I don't know if it stretched my imagination or just sort of crunch my head a little bit to make some of the timing work. It still seems a little bit off, but I'll suspend my disbelief enough to enjoy the novel, which, geez, I don't know. I wish I could say that the story, the actual plot was more imaginative and the solutions easier to come by or harder to come by. But it felt very much a bit of a cookie cutter book for me. You could have taken, in this case, they did use the Discovery as well as the Pike Enterprise, which sort of was a nice nod to continuity. And of course, Spock and Michael Burnham played large roles in the novels, but it seemed rather forced. More importantly, a lot of it seemed that it could have been any two characters and any two ships, and you could have just ran this whole storyline pretty much identically. So it was a bit a shame that I felt that the author in this case, and I typically do like his work, wasn't more imaginative.
You know, I'm wondering how much of that was because the plot, at least from their point of view, had to be pretty simplistic in order to allow the author to focus more on that dynamic between Burnham and Spock. Because I think when I was reading it, and I just happened to be reading the very middle, you know, meat of the book, where you really get a lot of the Burnham Spock stuff going on, almost at the exact same time that I saw the episode Leith for Discovery, which factors quite a bit in terms of the Burnham Sarek relationship, and even invokes Spock quite a bit. And yes, what I found was that the two of them complemented each other pretty well, but also really seemed to highlight that difficulty that we were having of how do you really reconcile Burnham's relationship to Spock and to Sarek and all of that, given what Spock's background is. So it became this very odd kind of combination there for me, and I still don't know that I'm completely convinced on that one. What did you think when you were reading that part?
Well, you know, I think they put it into a little bit better perspective in the sense that, at least that from what I read, Michael did not have that much interaction with Spock. He was significantly younger, and her ward status, I'm not sure she was having dinner with him every night, is the sort of feeling I got, that he was, I don't want to use quite the term big brother, I think it was a little bit more than that, but at the same time, I don't know that she was necessarily, you know, living with his family day in, day out either. It felt like he was more of a mentor or, you know, a guide that she could rely on. And maybe that, you know, that distance kind of helps to some extent. It worked out well because it really separated the two. I really didn't need another family member reveal as we had with Cybok in the original series in the movies.
Yeah, and that's for sure.
And I thought this idea that it was more of a mentoring kind of status feel to it worked better for me, that it helped step on less toes. And the only thing where they really went for the jugular was this whole thing about the what they call it. It wasn't the Vulcan Expeditionary Force. It was it was some term, and I'd never ever heard it before. So that was, but that's fine for them to create new things. I was just like, oh, okay. But for the reaction that he has, and that he was saving this honor, I guess, for Spock, seemed a little bit of a stretch for a ward. But it was interesting how the other Vulcans, who, and we know, despite their logic, are very, I guess I could use the term racist. They are very, they're very much full of themselves and feel that they are superior to, you know, just about everyone else in the galaxy. And, you know, he's like, and they viewed not only Burnham's tutorship or mentoring, as well as Spock's actual existence, to just be Sarek experiments. Yes. And actually, that fit quite well for what I admit is the bigotry that Vulcans often seem to be written with. So it fit very well. I have to give credit to the authors for sort of giving this whole – well, I guess I'm mashing together TV shows and books. But to give this sort of – this idea of this separation between the two worked for me, and it helped them not be either enemies or best of friends, just having shared common experiences more so than you know, family members who aren't talking to each other or – you know, or who have some great close bond together, which they didn't have. So I thought they struck a good balance between the two, and I don't really feel they violated any canon. Although honestly, we got almost no Enterprise except for I think a frustrated Captain Pike and a beaten up doctor for, Doctor from the Enterprise. But other than that, we really didn't get much Enterprise out of this, honestly. One or two scenes with Una, or the first number one from the original pilot, was very nice. But again, it just, they were such fleeting moments that I really feel that the no one except for Michael Burnham really got any justice in the novel.
And I still felt that when I got out of the novel, I guess you could say, and I was done and I was reflecting on it, that I still don't have a good sense of Burnham as a character. I think that there was a subtle thing that they did in the book, which was explain why she is perhaps in the mental, psychological space that she's in that first episode of Discovery. But at the same time, if you were to ask me what Burnham is like as a person, I have a real hard time with that. And while that may be something that, fans of Brian Fuller may have said, hey, you should have expected that sort of thing, I can tell you pretty well what Lorca's like. I can tell you what Saru's like. I can even tell you what some of the other supporting characters are like. I can't really tell you about Burnham. Burnham is still very much feels like a very indistinct and kind of overly complicated character, and I've now read an entire novel about her background, and I still don't feel like I know who this person is. And that, I think, actually is hurting the show, and for that matter, the novel, a little bit, because we are supposed to be using Burnham as the viewpoint character, I believe. And I don't think she is.
Do you think they are intentionally leaving this mystery, like just to float throughout the series, to not quite understand her motives, or to have them be somewhat oblique and not being able to tell what she'll do or what decision she'll make? Is it are they intentionally leaving her a wild card?
It's possible, but then I question whether or not that's the right way to go. I think that they are trying to say, what if Spock or someone like Spock were the main character of the show? Of Star Trek to begin with, and I think that there's a reason he's a supporting character. He's an amazing supporting character for the original series, but he's the supporting character because Kirk, and the tension between him, between the triad, between him, Spock, and McCoy, and Spock and McCoy being kind of these dual advisors to him in his more balanced approach, that works really well for very distinct reasons. And I think that having Burnham as almost like a pseudo Spock in this case as the main character, her inner conflict is not really translating to the screen or even to the page at this point. Because when they sit back and they say that she has a tendency to be overly pragmatic, then suddenly the character will do something completely impulsive and vice versa. And it's like, okay, wait a second, which is the default here? Or is the problem that there is no default, and therefore that's what we're supposed to be latching onto, but that's a little chaotic for somebody to take as a kind of, as I said, viewpoint. So I don't know if that's just the way it is, if it's the fact that they do want to have so many shades of gray in the series and in the concept. I liked one comment that somebody made, actually, is that this feels like the attempt to make a TV version of Vanguard.
I've mentioned that, and I don't think necessarily on any group that you're with, but yeah, I have mentioned that as well, because I think they're incorporating a chunk of Vanguard. This whole sort of mystery spore drive type of thing is very reminiscent of the Vanguard, the DNA
project? And all of that, Yeah,
so this whole mystery that Starfleet's working with type of thing definitely draws on things from Vanguard, and it was set in the same time period as well. Oh gosh, maybe we could get a Vanguard crossover too. Anyway, wishes. I don't doubt, and it's obvious that they've borrowed and pigeonholed from various things to both make this show fit in continuity wise, as well as try and sort of tie concepts in from into the universe that we're familiar with, and being the, I guess, prequel.
Yeah.
Even though Enterprise existed, even though this is technically, so even with that being the case, I don't fault them for that. I think people have wanted to see more things tied into Trek. So the fact that they're tying things into it, I really can't complain with as a concept. It's I'm trying to think. I just want to try and keep it to the book for the moment. But I thought the idea of them talking about making the Shinzu a much older ship makes a lot of sense to explain the differences between an Enterprise and a Shinzu. I did like to have more time on the Shinzu with Captain Garo.
Giorgio.
I like to have more time with that crew. I really felt that we did not get enough time with them. I regret their choice to move right over to Lorca. It's not that I don't care for Lorca, but geez, I thought that first crew still had so much more story that I would have liked to have seen. Mm-hmm. And I felt like we definitely lost them too big as a stunt to give Burnham a guilty conscience.
You're not wrong.
Yeah, I wish we had had more, but we didn't. But in the book, we did get a little bit more. So that was definitely one of the redeeming factors. We got to have a sense of it, and it definitely was not a try to shoot somebody dead or mutiny or anything like that. We actually got to see them in some sense, I guess, depending on how you picture books as you read them. We got even more time with them as a functioning crew. So that was definitely a fun thing. And if you sort of wanted more of that pre-discovery era of Michael Burnham being on the Shinzu, I definitely recommend the book. There's definitely a lot of that there's such a lot of commentary by Saru as well in there. That's kind of nice. So before he's traumatized, I guess, by the whole incident at the Battle of the Stars. And I definitely recommend the book. As I said, if you're looking for anything remotely TOS, because they mention it prominently in the blurbs for this book, don't bother. It's really not there, guys. But if you wanted to see a little bit more of what happened before the pilot/premiere episode, go definitely pick it up. You'll be glad you did.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's a bad read by any means. I just feel like it actually does a lot to highlight some of the strengths and weaknesses of the franchise so far. And to be entirely fair to David Mack, who is one of my favorite Star Trek writers right now, and has really been doing a great job along with some other familiar names to carry the torch for the ongoing novel continuity. If you look at some of the early novels for TNG, they struggle with some of the same things.
And by the way, John, if you haven't read the book, I might be saying something in the next minute or so that might spoil things. So if you don't want to get spoiled, pause us. If you do want to get spoiled, keep on listening, because I have one or two things more to say about the book before we finish our discussions.
Oh, absolutely.
Sorry, John, go ahead.
My main point was just the fact that if you go back to a couple of the early TNG books where they were still trying to get their footing as far as the setting and the character dynamics and really just about everything. There were some issues with characterization there too, and nothing earth-shattering, but similar to this book, where sometimes it just feels like things are a little bit off. So,
well, the fact that only Michael Burnham could go into the ship, and she could only take Spock with him because he's the only one that's going to think like she does, was a load of crap, if you ask mm-hmm. me. It was definitely a MacGuffin of a plot device to get the two together to have them interact, and it was that and this whole we found an alien spaceship buried under the ground that's going to destroy everyone. I mean, I guess it is Star Trek, but it just seemed like a weak premise. And then they,
You know what though?
Oh, yeah.
As something that happens just before or in the era before the original series.
Yes.
I found it interesting that they were so afraid that, oh man, we're going to unleash yet another thing we don't understand out and it's going to destroy colonies again. Because how many times does that seem to happen in the original series where it's like, oh look at this, it's a doomsday machine. Where did that come from? Oh, it ate a colony. Damn it.
Well, yeah, in some sense, they were being extremely proactive, and not only proactive, but quite aggressive.
Yes.
Basically, they were, at the first sign that this wasn't easily placated, they wanted to either destroy the thing or nuke the planet. Part of the plot line is them stalling basically for time to try and come up with allow Burnham to come up with another solution for it. And it was, it was quite an aggressive posture for, seem for them to take, because to the best knowledge, you had two probes, and I don't know how big these things are, but I want to think the size of like a motorcycle, but I'm guessing these are probably larger, like the size of a car, perhaps. I'm not quite sure. They never gave any sense of scale of them, but given how formidable they were able to keep up with a Starfleet, with a starship, they could not have been that small. So, perhaps there was something that was more impending than I seem to get out of their description from the books, but that they were willing to nuke a planet over it. But so, like I said, I was let down with the plot. I thought it was especially the Burnham going inside and them having to solve all sorts of brain teaser puzzles was somewhat annoying. The ability to necessarily solve puzzles put forward by a alien race is sketchy at best. And then to have to solve five of them, or I think four or five of them along the way, it was even more scratching my head, including one where you needed to be telepathic.
Yes.
let's hope evolution rolled that dice for you. But I was like, okay. Let's stretch it even more.
Flashbacks to the Berserker episode of Babylon 5 by any chance?
Yes.
Okay, good. It wasn't just me.
Yeah. No. But like I said, I mean, I understand that a lot of the plot was just a contrivance to have Burnham and Spock in an environment where they had to work through things that I don't think they really had in the first place, given their limited interaction other than having Sarek either as a father or some sort of role model figure. I never got the sense that they had any personal animosities against each other or issues that needed to be resolved through through a tense situation. But they got thrown into one anyway. And it just sort of made me scratch my head. I felt it was a bit of fan service to have these two put together in that capacity because, that's Sarek's son and she was, raised in some way by Sarek. So, that's got to be great to get them together. And it.
Yeah.
I didn't. Oh, geez. Sarek was a hard ass. Yeah, he sure was. Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Wow. Cool. I mean, that's sort of what I got out of it. So I was also disappointed. Not that I needed to find out that Sarek was beating them as children or anything along those lines, but I would have thought some other revelation might have come out of it, and it didn't. At least for me. I'm being a little critical. Was there, like I said, I thought I enjoyed the Shinzu pieces of this. I thought worked out well. I enjoyed the description and tenacity of the colonists that were trying to save their colony even after they find out that the Shinzu and Enterprise have been ordered to destroy the whole place. I found a lot of the characterizations to be quite entertaining.
Mm. There were quite a few, yes. I actually found like I got a better sense of Saru from this particular book than I have from the show so far. But
without that anger and frustration against Burnham, or at least the situation that he finds himself in because of her actions, I agree with you that I enjoyed my time on the Shinzu a lot during this book. So.
Definitely. I think that if you are a fan of the show, definitely, or just a fan of Star Trek novels in general, I would go ahead and pick this one up. Who knows, maybe you'll find some nuggets in there that we overlooked or that you enjoyed more than we did. But beyond that, Gary, what have you also been up to the last couple of weeks?
I went to a 30th anniversary showing of Princess Bride, and I'll admit, a lot of times when I'm talk about movies and stuff like that, I really don't see a big deal of watching it on, a home TV screen versus a movie theater. But and having a movie such as, Princess Bride, which so many people can quote lines for and always seem to know the general story of what went on and things of that nature, it was very entertaining to watch it on the big screen. I caught details and nuances that I honestly had not remembered from my original viewing more than 30 years ago. And it was really quite pleasurable to watch it up on the big screen. I even saw a favorite comic book series, Legion of Superheroes, that was on the boy's headboard behind him as he was getting his story read to that I'd never seen in my multiple TV viewings of it. So, it was quite enjoyable. You had a lot of obviously you're getting diehard fans showing up at a movie theater on a, Sunday night to watch something they could easily watch on demand or, if they don't have the DVD already. But it's a lot of fun. As we've talked about one or two of these events before, Fathom events, and they grab the different movies either for anniversaries or some other special occasion, and they run them in the way that the movies were meant to be seen on the big screen. And so it's a lot of fun. I'm actually going to see Casablanca next month, which is one of my all-time favorite movies as well in this format. So it's a lot of fun. If you look around, I mentioned Fathom, but there's a lot of other theater chains or even independent theaters that'll run an old movie from time to time. And if it's one you like, I definitely recommend, going there, sitting down with the popcorn and watching it. You might find a completely different enjoyment for the movie than you do just sitting on your couch.
Yes, Fathom Events, I find, is really where a lot of the movies I go to watch come from now. One I'll talk about in a moment comes from Fathom Events, and I think I've mentioned it before. The Studio Ghibli festival that they do every year, it's continuing into November, so the one here at the end of October that, as this goes out, I'm actually probably at. Quite honestly, I will be at if this goes out Monday night. I'll already be there. Spirited Away, which is one of the more well-known Ghibli movies, or Miyazaki's movies, is playing. And it's the subbed version, so of course it's the original Japanese with subtitles. But Fathom Events is the one that is holding this this quote-unquote festival, which is a monthly thing, and they literally play 6 months over, six movies over the course of 6 months. It's great. And really getting to be able to see the original print as it was released back in the day is really quite neat. And it's great to see it, as I'm sure you would agree, to see these films or see these as events where the people who are there are not simply casual fans. These are the ones who are looking forward to going and see one of their favorites on the big screen with a bunch of other uber fans. So that's always fun. I'm definitely looking forward to yet another great experience, seeing one of Miyazaki's movies up on the big screen. Did not get to see it last month, so I'm really looking forward to this month. And let's see, beyond that, also up on the big screen, this was not Fathom Events, it was technically Funimation that put it up. I did not even know or remember that they were making a live-action Tokyo Ghoul adaptation. And then I found out that they did, and little did I know, but soon, right after that, they announced, hey, and we're doing screenings of the film in the U.S. So, yeah, snatched up tickets for that. So I saw that a couple weeks ago, and I was pleasantly surprised. I know that Asia tends to do some really nice things with horror, but as anime adaptations go, they tend to be very over the top. I can't say that this wasn't over the top in some cases, but it was done so in a very consistent fashion. And there were some moments where they got some of the more grotesque imagery from the anime or the manga, and they got it on screen in live action, and I was quite impressed by that. A lot of the characterizations were down well, and it was a relatively good adaptation of the early, one of the first few story arcs of Tokyo Ghoul. So if you're a fan of that anime and you're willing to give it a shot, you haven't been completely burnt out by questionable anime adaptations, I recommend going and finding it if it's still around. It may not be, but hopefully they will have repeat showings. The unfortunate thing, and I'm sure that Gary, the same thing is, I'm not sure what you're doing, but it sounds like you're screwing a light bulb in right next to the...
Gotta change out LEDs, John.
That's
LEDs.
Right. But I don't know about you and like the Princess Bride thing, but what I find is that it's really awesome that they do these events. The downside is that these events last maybe a couple days, sometimes a week at most. Sometimes it's just one day.
Yeah, most I'm seeing is about Tuesday, 2 days. They're doing them on like a Sunday and like a Wednesday, and then it's gone. That's gone. Yeah.
So, yeah, it is something that you have to really keep your eye out on. I actually keep, on my browser, I have two or three tabs for the ones that I look for or look at the most. And I'm constantly refreshing to make sure that I get the most up-to-date content. Because, sometimes it just pops onto the schedule literally a week or two before it's out. Because, they have to get licensing, and then they have to book the theaters when theaters have an opening, and a lot of the time it's very selected theaters because they have to be big enough to have that flexibility. So, I actually have to travel quite far when we have these event movies, at least 40 minutes. So, during rush hour during the week, a 40-minute drive in this part of Jersey is not always easy. So it's a bit of a time investment, but I found that it's worth it. But it's something, if you are interested, it's not like you can just casually say, hey, I'll look it up and see if it's still in the theaters. More than likely, you needed to know about it before we told you. So,
yeah, I agree.
Yeah. At any rate, sometimes you do get lucky and they expand the number of theaters and the number of nights. That tends to happen with the more popular events. So always keep your eye on fathomevents.com or funimationfilms.com. There's a couple of other ones out there as well that you could probably find easily enough.
But yeah, or just
seems to be the one that does the most of it these days.
Yeah, or just check your local movie theater next time you go and say, oh, do you ever show anything not new? And they're usually more than glad to tell it because they make so much money off the tickets of these non-new movies that it's well worth them to promote them. So, yeah.
Well, as I said, it could be in your area that the nearest theater is 40 or 50 minutes away because it is limited theater distribution. So it may not even be their local theater, but it's worth asking. Always worth asking. Especially if you're in a bigger town, they may know where things are going to be, even if they don't run them. Let's see. Beyond that, Gary, I saw something else here on this list that I'm intrigued by.
Yeah, and I'll preface what I'm going to say by saying it's not what you think it is. we went out to see, it's an independent movie. It's called The Florida Project with William Dafoe. And it's actually about a story about the less fortunate people in the Orlando area that live in some of the older hotels and condos, you know, really people who are scraping by day to day just to trying to make a living, and how even in the sort of glow of such, you know, such a place like Disney World or Universal with all these amazing hotels and activities and events, that there's a very underbelly to it of hard off people who possibly by their choice or not by their choice find themselves in very difficult circumstances. And it followed the story of people who lived in one of the hotels. And if you've ever been down to the Disney World area or driven through, you'll go by what you feel are rundown hotels. You know, the ones that are amazing, and the ones that aren't usually stand out. And they basically followed the story of one or two people that were living in one of those hotels over the course of several weeks, and what their life is like and ups and downs that happen. They based it on actual real events. The director and writer actually went around for over a year and a half interviewing these type of people until they had enough stories put together to, you know, make the movie. It was shown at the Cannes Film Festival and won several awards. And then they just struck a distribution deal, and it probably will. You'll start seeing some promotion for it, I believe, around Thanksgiving time. I'm not sure what kind of budget it'll have, but William Dafoe was excellent in it. I wouldn't say he played sort of an everyman with a heart of gold, just trying to get through his day, and he did a really good job on it. I mean, I enjoy him playing crazy too, but when he's playing somebody who's trying to do good, he's even better. I really loved him a lot in the project. He's the only name, so for me to mention other people, you know, wouldn't have any sort of reference for him. He was definitely the big name with the project, but he was excellent in it, and I wouldn't say he was the main character, but definitely a strong second.
Yeah, you're right. That isn't what I was expecting that movie to be about, but that's pretty awesome. Let's see.
Go ahead.
No.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I see. Have you read any other books besides the one we got to share in the last week or so?
The softball gets thrown, and
yes.
actually, I am right now in the, I wouldn't say the middle, I am somewhat into, the book is called Use of Weapons, which is the third of the Culture novels by Ian M. Banks. Edmund has talked about these before. I think that he has actually read this book as well in the past. But I've mentioned the culture books before in the sense that if we want to tie this into what we were talking about earlier, it's essentially kind of like the darker aspects of what it would take for the Federation to basically expand and maintain its kind of utopian culture. These things happen at a price, and it takes a very kind of, what's the word for it, very realistic and pragmatic approach to it, which is to say that we would love to believe that it's just all one big happy family, you know, Starfleet, you know, kind of going out and shaking hands and convincing everybody that everything is okay. But it takes a more of a Section 31 approach, which is to say that everyone gets to have their utopian society because of these people that are doing these things on the fringes that you don't necessarily hear about. And they're often violent or questionable, and it kind of brings up the whole question of, you know, imagine reading a book from the point of view of the operative in Serenity. That would be another way to put it.
Hmm.
where, okay, you know, he actually had in that movie some pretty interesting justifications and motivations where he understood, I'm doing the things that allow the society that we want to exist, and by virtue of that, I accept that I cannot be part of that society or not part of the normal part of that society. And so, yes, right now it's actually the book takes a slightly irreverent bent to it right now, in that you are dealing with a couple of these agents that are, you know, tasked with, instead of following the prime directive and going and mildly observing a culture, they are actually going into into these places and undermining them in order to make them more amenable to kind of absorption into the culture. So it's kind of a slightly darker side to a Federation type of society, which is very interesting. That and the fact that unlike the Federation, they openly embrace like biological experimentation, genetic manipulation, machine, biological and machine,
like
cybernetics, drone, like basically they have drones or and such that are sentient and so forth. And there, it's hard sci-fi. So I'm also, there's a lot of detail that goes into it. But it's definitely thought provoking because you as we sit back and we even say, Discovery is showing us a very different and grittier side to Star Trek. And this is basically saying, well, that's even a very pie in the sky version of things, an idealized version of things, compared to, say, if we were to, and I believe this is actually the intent, kind of think about, like, what if the Federation had their own, like, CIA black ops group, like Section 31, right? But even more acknowledged and fostered by the Federation Council or something like that. So definitely an interesting book. I am enjoying it. And
now, is it a one-off or is it like an ongoing series with that storyline, or is it like an anthology kind of?
Well, the way that the series works so far that I can tell is that it's a loose universe in the sense that each book is self-contained, but it takes place in various time periods over the course of the existence of this culture. Which is why it's a culture novel, but it's not like you need to read books 1 and 2 in order to understand 3.
Okay.
No, it's more like if you read them in published order, because of the fact that there are little details that start to accumulate, you have a better sense of the world that it's set in, but that's about it. Each one is, at least as far as I know, at least the 3 that I've read, you can pick it up and read it on its own merits. It just happens to be in the same setting as the other novels. Like, all the novels are in obviously the same setting.
Okay, I got you.
Yeah. So let's see, that's it. Other than that, I'm looking forward to eventually seeing Thor Ragnarok. I hope to see it before we record again.
I do have to say, I'm enjoying the new version of the trailers that they've been putting out for it. It definitely has a very different feel, and I feel like they're giving us a little bit more of an idea of what the movie is. It almost seemed a little slapstick, and now we're starting to see that it's not quite that, which is nice. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it. The Hela character looks amazing. I'm curious to see what they do with Valkyrie, given that she's supposed to work for Hela. Then at the same time, they've decided to recast the role as with an African or African American actress. So I'm curious if that denotes that there's going to be some sort of character change as well to the character. So that's something I'm looking forward to seeing. I never thought that the character was ever really fleshed out well when I was reading the Defender comic books. So I really hope they give her a decent backstory and reason for her breaking with her boss. So seems like a lot of fun, and I'm curious to see how they integrate Hulk into it. It always seems like such a wild force. I'm curious how they managed to do that. So
yeah, it definitely sounds like there's some kind of there's a lot of plot stuff that still needs to be revealed, and I'm looking forward to what they come up with. But that's why I feel like it's rare for me to get this close to one of these films and really not know what I'm going to go walking into. And that's actually a good thing from my point of view. I think that this is going to be a lot of fun. And like I said, I am looking forward to it. So let's see. Beyond that, there are just a couple things that I wanted to talk about. Hey, that Han Solo movie got a title. Wasn't that shocking?
Wow, geez. Well, the shocking part for me is that was news.
Yeah. And the title is
Solo?
Yeah, that's so original. What would you rather it have been, or something like? I know it's weird, but I almost feel like I would have liked it to have been something like more You know how Rogue One was kind of a surprising reference to, you know, some minor detail in the story, and it was like, if you looked at the title Rogue One, you had no idea that it was actually about the Death Star. So, yeah, I almost feel like, okay, Solo, wow. Does that have deeper meaning, or is it simply because it's about Han Solo?
Well, you know, I thought to myself...
That would have been an interesting thing to kind of give you, like, ooh, what's that?
Yeah, Well, it's supposed to be Solo, and I guess I don't know if this will be the story of how he gets the Falcon or not.
It supposedly originally thought that way, but who knows?
I would have preferred them to go with, sort of in the genre of, you know, the whole Pulp Fiction idea. I would have loved to have called something like Han Solo and the Kessel Run or something like that. You know, something that was a little bit longer, I guess.
Well, if it was the Kessel Run, for instance, and that's what it is, then I almost would have liked to have seen that. Just, you know, Kessel Run. Something like, just, I don't know, something more. Something that gives you, like, an excitement. Because that's just kind of like, yeah, you just told us what we already knew. Great, thanks. You didn't give me anything to really sink my teeth into.
Nope.
But I guess they're, you know, this is, you know, Disney's attitude about these movies to a certain extent is, we can throw these at you and we know you're going to show up. Even if it's to see how much you can be pissy about it.
Well, you know. The first Star Wars movie paid for the entire purchase of Lucasfilm in one movie, so
in like one day.
Yeah, so they're really I don't know. It is what it is. The more longtime older fans, and I don't mean that a disparaging term, but you know, we got a lot of detail over the years in the novels that, you know, we did, a lot of other franchises might not have had that opportunity. They were all kept in canon, and in some cases had some shaking results. You know, I think of the whole Yuuzhan Vong crisis, and while some of the books were spotty, overall that was a significant impact on that universe, and it was always considered canon. So, you know, if you want to think of those as movies, the original Thrawn trilogy, you know, there were several impactful things, sadly in book form, not on movies, but, you know, we definitely still got to experience the universe in new and exciting ways for decades, even without new movies. So, I mean, we've gotten a lot, and, you know, you have an old fan, you have a new fan, and they have to put people in the seats in the movie theaters, and, you know, you got to change things around sometimes. So it's one of those things, you know, be grateful for what we had and look forward to the future, I guess. It changes, but it's not all bad. So we'll see. They've had a lot of director issues with this movie so far. So I'm curious to see what direction it's going to be. I hear stories about Kathleen Kennedy, who's running the franchise now, really exercising a heavy hand with the movies and giving directors a lot less freedom to create and shoot. So I'm curious to see what the finished product's going to look like with such a heavy hand. And I heard a lot of people complaining about that. And I'm thinking to myself at the same time, Lucas signed off like on everything. He'd have a little stamp because he was sick of signing off. So he'd just stamp everything after a while. So, I mean, he was checking everything. So this idea that you shouldn't micromanage the franchise, I think is a bit misplaced, because it was micromanaged for, you know, for decades. He saw, or at least generally approved of, everything done. So, yeah. You know, we have had a micromanaged franchise since pretty much the beginning. So I'm not sure what the, you know, why everyone's all of a sudden, oh gosh, Kathleen Kennedy's, you know, having tight control over everything. She's overruling directors. Heck, for Return of the Jedi, he fired his longtime producer who just finished Empire with all its awards and accolades and, you know, mega box office. The guy said, I don't like the story, you need to change it. And Lucas said tough, and the guy left. So, you know, because he said, well, I don't want to get into the teddy bear issues right now, but he just said that, you know, I don't like the way the movie's going, I want to do it some way different. And Lucas just said, no, I want to do it this way, so you're out. And so, you know, we're seeing a lot of that sort of same authority pushed around, and it really shouldn't be something someone's not used to. This is the way Star Wars has been run, and it looks like it's continuing to be run that way. There's one person with a vision, and it's their vision or the highway.
Well, I'm just going to point out one other thing, too, is that those who are maybe thinking, well, hey, you know, we didn't have that kind of a problem with Star Trek or whatever else, and we still did fine. I'm just going to remind them of the Berman years. And how kind of things got very predictable after a while. Between that and there was that whole period where, before Roddenberry died, that the novels were so over managed and micromanaged that they had like pages upon pages of rules that you had to follow that pretty much almost destroyed some of the shared universe hijinks that used to be one of the highlights of the novels back in the early 80s. Certainly, I noticed, and maybe you noticed too, because I think you were a reader even back then as well, that you know the early novels for Star Trek were... They referred to one another all the time. And then all of a sudden, shortly after the success of Next Generation, there was, I think his last name was Arnold, was a...
Richard Arnold.
Yeah. That's it. He stamped everything down, and it was like every book that came out was just self-contained, very non-offensive. You couldn't do certain things with the main characters. You know,
you couldn't do anything with
them. Yeah. It was really quite disappointing for a while. I mean, there were some good ideas that got snuck in, but there is definitely there was a lot of disappointment from a lot of the readers and such. So there in these big franchises, you have to, in order to for it to survive, you really do have to have at least some kind of major backing from a studio or from you know, or financial backer, and that automatically means that you're going to have some level of creative control and kind of a guiding hand that can be benevolent. It can be malevolent. You can see it as even both, but I don't see any reason why people should be that afraid of what is happening with Star Wars just because Disney is the owner of Lucasfilm now. When you see that the creativity, we literally just got done talking about how Thor Ragnarok looks like it's going to defy our expectations. How many movies have been under the Disney stamp for Marvel Studios? And we still feel like there is a lot of creativity getting onto the screen. There's no reason why we can't have the same thing happen with the Star Wars films, and we've literally only seen two. And what's the one thing that everybody says about Rogue One is that it was, wow, that was a lot better than I expected.
Yeah.
So I think the fear is still because of some uncertainties, because there isn't that much material out there, and because The Force Awakens seemed to be so cookie cutter, and people still aren't sure that was in fact intentional, or that it was intentional for all the wrong reasons. Let's give it time, in my opinion, but I just don't like the lack of creativity in the title. It just seems lazy. That's all I was getting at. It was like, oh, come on. Give us a little something more to like kind of just whet our appetites. You know, there's just been so much kind of craziness in the background, and quite frankly, I'm still not sold that Ron Howard is absolutely the person to be doing in one of these movies, but, you know, give me something to really get me excited about it, because right now I'm still like, huh. We've heard about the performance of the lead actor, about the fact that that it was, you said Thor kind of came across as slapstick, but that was the rumor about the Han Solo movie too, was that there was concern that it was too broadly comedic. So, yeah, I don't know. We'll see. all in good time, right?
Yep.
All right, well, I think we're going to go ahead and wrap up this episode because we have been going a little long. And then when we come back next time, we will get into some episodic discussion. I have a feeling there's one show we're going to talk about. Definitely. I can't imagine what it is, though. We'll just have to discover it on our own. Until then.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google+, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the Critical Myth.